Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Bible Answers right after this message. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water, about 286,000 cubic miles of it. And for century after century, millennium after millennium, all of this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as 1 inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed, we can observe that today. And that's because every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Well, in the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood and its laws are fully comprehended. Modern science, then, has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And that's just one of the many lessons in the Mosaic Law School that I conduct here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. This Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. For more information, just call and order my free general law CD package. That's the place to start. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email, send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, let's continue on. We're talking about licensing. I received a letter from a student at Concordia St. Louis Seminary, and we'll probably be getting married very soon. I'm very interested in the subjects that you deal with, but first and foremost, I'm interested in marriage. I'm always apprehensive about starting something new that is life-altering, and the fact that I need a license makes me wary because it seems so unnecessary. I'm interested in your thoughts, signed by Mark. All right, well, last time we talked about licenses and Dr. Everett Sullivan and gave you a few pointers. Now, let's continue on this line of marriage, children, birth certificates, marriage license. Now let's talk about education, because out of marriage comes babies. It's just one of those natural phenomenons that occurs in life. You get married and you're more likely going to have some children. Who's going to own those children, and who's going to decide how you discipline them, what education you give them? I mean, you know, people will call and they'll complain about education, and they'll say, well, I'm opposed to sex education in public school, or I'm opposed to evolutionary philosophy being taught in public school. Well, boys and girls, if you're opposed to that, why don't you change? You know, if somebody said to me, I'm really dissatisfied and I'm opposed to Walmart, gee, why don't you go shop at Kmart or someplace else? You know, there are choices that you make in life. People complain about about being searched and all of the Homeland Security and Patriot Act and one thing and another on the airlines. Why don't you travel some other way? That's what I did. I've mentioned it before. I used to spend a lot of money flying on airliners. I haven't spent a dime on an airplane since 9/11, and I'm not going to spend another dime on an airplane until they change their policies. I have a choice to make, and I've made my choice. I'm not complaining about the Patriot Act or the Homeland Security or the airline security. I mean, if that's what they want to do, don't let me get in the way of their happiness and success. I'm not complaining about the public schools. I put programs on and I said, did you know what's going on in your public school? I mean, let me tell you what's going on and you can make a decision or a choice. Well, John Gatto, he's an educator, an author, and he wrote an article here, Schools Threaten Families. And he was the keynote speaker at the Utah Home Education Association conference. And he said that public schooling is out of control. Okay, I would agree with that. I think public school is out of control, too. That's why I don't educate my children in public school. But, you know, I wouldn't tell you that you shouldn't. But I think that you should be informed as to what the problems are in public school so that you can make an informed choice as to whether or not you want to educate your child in public school. I mean, it's a choice that you make, and I think that you ought to make it. Well, here's what Gatto had to say. He said, parents who turn over the education of their children to the state risk sacrificing their family as a result, according to author and award-winning educator John Gatto. Gatto is a three-time New York City Teacher of the Year from 1989 to 91 and a New York State Teacher of the Year in 1991. He delivered the keynote address at the Utah Home Education Association Conference June 5th at the Utah Valley Community College. The author of Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Education, Gatto has been honored by Presidents Reagan, President Carter, and President Ford. The annual conference will feature dozens of classics and workshops on a variety of educational topics. Further information may be obtained by calling. If the family doesn't have the principal say over the education of its children, only in the thinnest sense is it a family at all, so said Gatto in a telephone interview from his home in New York City. He said, education is a parental, not a governmental responsibility. Let me just pause right there. That's precisely what God Almighty told you, that government, that is the king, shouldn't have any input at all over the education of your children. Now, your Creator, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, told you to educate your children, and He told you how to educate them and what to educate them to. Now, of course, we decided that the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto trumped the Mosaic Law, and we're not going to have any part of that. Now, there are a few of us, a few, not very many, but a few of us, that educate our children at home. Now, you're going to have a tough row to hoe if you've got your marriage license, social security numbers, birth certificates, and then half of you are on welfare, and then you want to tell the owner of the child, the state, that you're not going to educate the child the way the state wants that child educated. Now, let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose that you bring your children over to me and you say, Gordon, I want you to educate and to take care of my children for a year. I'm going to Europe. And so I say, okay. And so you give me my instructions. And in my instructions, you say, I want you to send my children to the local Catholic school. And then I want you to do A, B, C, and D. And I say, okay, and you leave. And so I send your children to the local Lutheran school or the local public school. And I don't do A, B, C, D. I do Z, Y, X, W, V. You're over in France and you learn of this. What would you do about that? What would you do if you found that I wasn't educating your child the way you wanted them educated? wasn't rearing your child the way you wanted him reared. Wouldn't you change babysitters? Now, when you get married with a state marriage license and you start having babies, you become the state's babysitter under the doctrine of parents patriae. That's all there is to that. That's no big mystery. That's the way the law is. I didn't make the law that way. I'm just reporting to you that's the way it is. Now, this educator, John Gatto, comes to the conclusion that the responsibility for educating children is parental, not governmental. And he goes on to say the whole point is that parents and their children have this wonderful reciprocity in education that has to be largely self-created. The state broke into that equation about 100 years ago. Gatto is a 30-year veteran of the public school system, having taught children of all economic and age levels. He retired in 1991. He has been busy lecturing, giving educational workshops, and encouraging parents to look outside the public schools for their children's education. Now, an example of the growing threat posed by government and its schools, Gatto said, can be found in a proposed legislative resolution that he obtained during a recent visit to the Wichita, Kansas public schools. In part, the resolution reads, quote, "Whereas public schools have become the primary institution for the rearing of children and the transmission of values." Let me pause right there. "Whereas the public schools have become the primary institution for the rearing of children." Okay, you want your children reared under the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. Why should you be surprised then if they turn out to be socialists and communists? It's what you wanted. "And whereas families, churches, and other social institutions are no longer able to successfully fulfill these responsibilities." Hey, listen. Evidently, your church, your home, your family is unable to rear your children and educate them, so you're going to send them to the state. Well, okay. Then why are you complaining about the state and the way they rear their children? Makes all the sense in the world to me. If I'm your babysitter, then I'm educating your children and you don't like it, you change babysitters. Wait a minute, you can't change the state's babysitter. The state owns the child. So you want to think about that, Mark. Before you marry, you should have an agreement. This is called the prenuptial agreement with your wife. Can two walk together except they be agreed? How are you going to handle the marriage license, birth certificates, inoculations, homeschool versus public school, the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, divorce? How are you going to handle it? Well, the state's got a program, and God has a program, and the choice is for you to make, not for George Gordon to make for you, or for the state to make for you. In Deuteronomy 30, God told you, Mark, he said, "Choose you now. Choose between me and Baal." Joshua had that choice to make, and he said, "Well, as for me and my house, we're going to choose God and the Mosaic Law." Now he goes on to say, "Therefore, public schools should be the principal caregiving institution in this state and shall henceforth exercise final decision-making authority on all matters regarding the existence, the nurture, and the upbringing of all children in the state of Kansas," unquote. So, okay, what's wrong with that? I mean, look, boys and girls, if you want to give your children to the state, don't get angry when the state says, "This is the way we want our child raised." Now, if on the other hand, you want to keep the child, well, that's another story. You can do that. But you know, many of you people, you know, you go out and you get a social security number and you've got a birth certificate and you belong to the state. Then you come along and you say, "Well, gee, I don't want to follow the state's mandates. I don't want to get inoculations for my children." what you're really saying is, I don't want to get inoculations for the state's children. You know, if you hire me to be your babysitter, I might become pretty attached to your children, but, you know, the bottom line is, they're not mine, they're yours, and if you want them shot up with snake venom and monkey pus, that's your choice. And if your child comes down with autism or some other side effect, well, you made your choice. I've had people complain to me and say, you know, Gordon, you're insensitive. Well, okay, so I'm insensitive. But I just called some like I see them. That's all I can do. I'm going to tell you what I think. I'm going to give you the facts. I'm not going to sit here and cajole with you and see if I can convince you that George Gordon's right and you're wrong. I don't care. The decision's yours to make. Make it. Now, he goes on to say, Gatto is a 30-year veteran of the public schools. Well, if Gatto is a 30-year veteran of the public schools, do you think maybe he might know something about the public school system that you don't know? I just kind of crossed my mind. I thought, well, if he's been in the public schools for 30 years and he comes out and says, the public school system sucks, and that's why Johnny can't read. Oh, I'm not a veteran of the public school system. I'm an observer of the products that come out of the public school system, and what I have observed is something that I don't want to buy. I observe the ignorance of children that come out of the public school system, and when I was an employer, I would have people come in and they'd fill out a job application and they'd say, well, I'm a high school graduate. And these people couldn't read and write. I'm a high school graduate. Now, they never told me they couldn't read and write. I'd hire them, give them a written communication. They couldn't read it. They couldn't comprehend it. They couldn't follow those instructions. And I said, well, gosh, if that's what the public schools are turning out, I don't want to send my children there. So I picked up a couple of books on public education. I said, well, it looks like to me that perhaps my children are my responsibility. The 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto shifts that responsibility off to the state. And, of course, the state of Kansas is very excited about that, and they say, well, you know, in all matters regarding the existence, nurture, and upbringing of all children in the state of Kansas, then we're going to take that responsibility. Well, if parents can't assume that responsibility, then what's wrong with the state assuming it? Now, when you subordinate the family, and this is John Gatto, he goes on to say, when you subordinate the family to some larger purpose, you've already destroyed the culture. I think Kansas is being used, as Michigan and Oregon have been for many, many years, as a test state. I think the Federal Department of Education's reach is intense and spider-like across a web of state education departments, and I think, by and large, all state education departments are part of the same organism. Gatto said schools are good at schooling, but not at educating. Did you get that? Gatto said schools are good at schooling, but they're not good at educating. As a result, he said, the social pathology generated by government schools has launched America down the same road of failure traveled by the Soviet Union. We're not talking about education, we're talking about schooling, which is a much different thing. Schooling is a form of training and indoctrination. In small doses, it's probably a useful thing, and it has been recognized as such through human history, he said. But in large doses, it totally destroys the function of the family. It destroys the function of the church, the neighborhood, the culture. We're in the hands of some kind of utopian agenda that achieved a position of dominance at the beginning of the century. What is public about an institution that uses the police power of the state to guarantee its clientele, and that is immune from criticism and responsibility? If agents of the state indoctrinate your children to their own myths, do you think that anything conceivably good could come out of that? Lamentably, Gatto said, most people still don't understand the damage that kindergarten and elementary school do to your child. He said a mandatory kindergarten law such as adopted during Utah's last legislative session, is an absolutely hideous thing. Gatto attributed his teaching awards to the success of his students. He said he may not have won the awards had he been questioned about his educational views and methods. They assumed somehow or other that I had figured out a way to make the thing work, he said of public schooling. Well, I scrapped the public school system rules. The way to improve education, Gatto said, is not through a standardized curriculum or through centralized government indoctrination and control. There isn't any systematic solution because kids don't learn in a systematic fashion. If you impose a system on kids, you guarantee that the majority of those children will be mutilated by that system, he said. Once you centralize a curriculum, any prospect of any education is lost. Now, I've pointed this out. I'll make a comment here. Education is the dissemination of information. Schools don't disseminate information. They indoctrinate. They give you a book, and they say, read chapter 9, and we'll have a test on chapter 9 on Friday. Then they ask you questions about the material contained in chapter 9. That's indoctrination. Education is where we question chapter 9. Who said? Why is that true? Why do we believe what we believe? Who says that that's true, accurate, or correct? Education is where we learn to think and to think for ourselves. I'd say Mark is on the right track. He's asking the question, why should I get a marriage license? I can't answer you, Mark. I cannot tell you why you should get a marriage license. I can't see any logic, reason, or common sense to it. If marriage licenses were necessary and imperative, if they were good for us, wouldn't God have written a marriage license statute into the Mosaic Law and said, look, when you want to get married, you go to the priest and you get a marriage license? Now here's what this marriage license does. It binds you to the statutes of the state. So you go down and you get a marriage license and you bind yourself to a three-party limited general partnership, the boy, the girl, and the state. Now the state can change the terms and conditions of that contract anytime the legislature is in session. So let's suppose that in the year 2005, Mark, you get married, you get a marriage license, and in the year 2008, the state legislature enacts some new provisions. Did you think they're going to send you a letter and say, by the way, all of you people that joined up with the state program in 2005, let us update you on the changes? No, they're not going to tell you anything about those changes. Mark, are you and your wife going to go into the legislature and testify before committees as to changes that you want made in the welfare laws, marriage laws? No, you probably aren't. But you can rest assured that educators from your public schools are going to be there. That groups and organizations like the North American Man-Boy Love Association is going to be there, promoting legislation, regulating you, your wife, and your child. Do you really want some gay organization coming into the legislature making proposals as to how your child should be raised, educated, reared? You think that the Department of Social Services and the social agenda of the New World Order is in your best interest or in your child's best interest? Or do you think maybe you could handle that yourself? I mean, these are wild, new, politically incorrect concepts. Individual responsibility over collective government intrusion into your responsibility. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should abolish the public school system. The Messiah once made an observation. He says, the poor you have with you always. The ignorant, those that are handicapped and unable to educate their children, or unable or unwilling to support and feed and clothe and house and take that kind of responsibility, somebody has to do it. And I guess the state's the institution to handle that. You know, when people are schizophrenic or they're insane and they don't have family, I guess the state is the source of last resort to take care of those people, aren't they? But you know, if you're a responsible citizen, if you're a responsible person, shouldn't you feed, clothe, house, and take care of yourself, number one, your wife, number two, and your children, number three? Do you remember that the Apostle Paul made this observation? He says, a man that fails to take care of his wife and family is worse than an infidel. Well, education is a part and parcel of your home and your family. Gatto said he is encouraged by the rapidly growing number of parents taking responsibility for their children's education. But those parents, he said, can expect increased government usurpation of their right to educate their children. And I've observed that over the years. That's true, accurate, and correct. The government comes in and tries to usurp your rights, your power to educate your child, your choice of homeschooling. After all, it's costing them $35 a day. $35 a day, every day your kid isn't in school. Now, about 2 million people are now educating their children in homeschool. 2 million. Sandra Day O'Connor, justice on the Supreme Court, is homeschooled. There are becoming now more numerous examples of Sandra Day O'Connors in our society. Colleges and universities now have special programs for homeschooled children and their admission into college. Your child educated in homeschool is more likely, statistically more likely, to be accepted in university or college than a public educated child. New facts, new information. Now, they used to say, my God, if you educate your child at home, you'll never get into college. Oh, that may have been true when there were only a few hundred thousand, but now there's 2 million, and it's growing at the rate of 20% a year. So there are more and more people becoming dissatisfied with the public school and the government system. That doesn't mean that the public school and government system is going to disappear, or that George Gordon is going to be the catalyst to abolish them. I'm not even trying. I don't care. I'm just interested in one guy, Mark, who writes a letter and says, what about this marriage license? All right, Mark, stand by. We're going to tell you about the marriage license. Now, hospitals collect a new baby tax. Back in 1986, up in Sioux City, Iowa, this was reported in the Sioux City Journal. The legislature of Iowa enacted a statute, and they said, when you go to the hospital, you have to get a birth certificate for your baby. Why would the state be concerned about creating a law that makes you get a birth certificate? Or we'll punish you. We'll fine you $300. Because you see, with the birth certificate, you give title to the child to the state. So the state says, if you don't give me your baby, we're going to fine you $300. Isn't that just real special? Can the state do that? Sure they can. Just picture yourself being in a mental hospital, and you marry a mental patient in the mental hospital. While you and your wife are patients in the mental hospital, don't you think that the hospital staff has the capacity to enact rules and regulations in the hospital for you? Against your will and over your objection? Mark, why don't you think about getting a discharge from the mental hospital, the state of Missouri? Stand by, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, we're talking about marriage. Should I get a marriage license? Well, my conclusion was that I didn't need one. My wife's conclusion was that she didn't need one. We homeschooled our last child. She's now 16 years old, getting ready for college. 16 years old and getting ready for college. She already achieved 12th grade, 6th month at age 12 years old. The Lutty School over here said there isn't anything more that we can do for this girl. She's already past 12th grade level. Our daughter can read. We're not suffering from Johnny can't read, and our daughter hasn't been dumbed down. That was my experience. Now, this marriage has a couple of laws that you should be familiar with. Marriage also has attended to it this thing of inheritance. So under the civil law, marriage and inheritance tax go together like a hand in a glove. Well, under the law of Moses, we have a couple of obscure statutes here. Let's take a look at them. One of them is called the duty of the husband's brother. It's a rare event. I've never seen this happen, but you read about it in the book of Ruth. Ruth was the product and her offspring, which ultimately led to the Messiah, or the offspring that derived from this statute in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10. It says, if brethren dwell together and one of them die and has no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger, and her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. Now you see that exact process in the royal family of England. Queen Elizabeth, the daughter, married a fellow by the name of Mountbatten, but she didn't take his name. She kept her name Windsor, and her firstborn son, Charlie Windsor, now becomes the heir. He's not Charlie Mountbatten, he's Charlie Windsor, and this statute, Deuteronomy 25, is being affected. But why? What's the purpose in it? Well, the purpose in it is the inheritance. The inheritance. You see, the inheritance laws of the Scripture are dependent upon this thing called marriage. And in verse 7, if a man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders that say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him, and if he stand to it and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him that has his shoe loosed. Now, that's kind of an obscure law. I haven't seen it necessary to put into practice, but from time to time, it could be for those of us that practice the Mosaic Law, which includes polygamy. I know that that's politically incorrect, but polygamy comes from God. And the concepts that we've developed here in America in our opposition to polygamy and our acceptance of miscegenation are exactly backwards. Well, it's exactly backwards to the scripture. David had several wives, as did Jacob, had four wives. In fact, there are 24 cases of polygamy in the Bible. They're not all like King Solomon. He went to excess, but I'm just pointing out that this could produce a case where if you already had a wife, you'd have to take this husband's brother duty. Well, that's assuming that you wanted to practice the law of Moses. Now, the reason for that comes under the marriage laws and inheritance that you see in Numbers chapter 36. You see, the chief fathers of the families of the children of Gilead, and it names them here, and the fathers of the children of Israel, and they said, "The Eternal commanded my Lord to give the land for an inheritance by lot to the children of Israel, and my Lord has commanded, or was commanded by the Lord, to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, unto his daughters. And if they be married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the children of Israel, then shall their inheritance be taken from the inheritance of our fathers, and shall be put into the inheritance of the tribe whereinto they are received. So shall it be taken from the lot of our inheritance. So when the jubilee of the children of Israel shall be, then shall their inheritance be put into the inheritance of the tribe whereinto they are received, so shall their inheritance be taken away from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers." So Moses commanded the children of Israel, according to the word of the Eternal, saying, "The tribe of the sons of Joseph hath said well." And what we're dealing with here is called a judgment. And we practice that in our civil law today. You see, if you have a controversy under a statute, you appeal it up. Finally, it gets to the U.S. Supreme Court for a policy decision. Well, this policy decision comes from Exodus chapter 18, where Moses was commanded to appoint captains over tens, fifties, hundreds, thousands, and ten thousands. And then on the Day of Atonement, they would go into the Holy of Holies, and God sitting on the mercy seat would judge these matters, these judgments. Today we say, well, we don't want to do that. After all, that's Old Testament stuff. And we want to have a Supreme Court where our judges can judge. So we use the same forms. We pollute it and pervert it, but we're still doing the same things. We just call it by a different name. We call it the Supreme Court instead of the Holy of Holies. And we call our priests judges instead of priests. That's the only difference. They still wear robes. They don't wear the white linen ephod. Today they wear black robes and identify themselves with Satan, the prince of darkness. And they practice the Roman civil law, an act of treason against the Ten Commandments, and particularly the first commandment that says, "You shall have no other gods before me." So in Numbers chapter 36, then, what we're reading here is when you have an inheritance because of the land Sabbaths and Jubilees, because of the duty of the husband's brother, as it relates to marriage, these marriage laws here become pretty significant. And when we don't practice these marriage laws, well, then we lose our property and property rights, and of course, then we have what we call the death tax. You die, and then you have to sell your property or your estate in order to pay off your partner, the United States of America or the state of New York, to pay the inheritance tax for the marriage license that you got because the state is your partner. Picture it this way. You and I and one other guy buy an apartment house. And I'm named as the managing general partner, and I'm working along as the managing general partner. And as we're progressing along, one of the partners dies. So I come along and say, well, that's good. Now, those two surviving partners will divide it up. Or what if I said, I'll just take it all? Wouldn't the surviving partner say, wait a minute, buy me out? Well, that's all you're dealing with here is property and property rights. Now, the state and the politicians, they're pretty crafty people. They don't want to work by the sweat of their face. They want you to work and to support the bureaucracy. And that's what you're doing. You work to support this bureaucracy. And you have to give up your property rights to do that. And a marriage license is a surrender of your property and property rights. All right, now there's another element that comes into the equation here. In my tax and status class, when we get to this letter, to this lesson, and we deal with a thing here called a contract for marriage. This contract for marriage is a marriage covenant. Marriage covenant. And in a patriarchal family, a patriarchal marriage, what we do is we have a contract between the boy and the girl's father. Let me show you how that works. Marriage is one that comes in one of three packages. Marriage is a civil law marriage, which is a three-party limited general partnership involving the boy, the girl, and the state. It is an agreement or a contract by, for, among, or between these three parties as evidenced by the marriage license. So that's number one. A civil law marriage then is a three-party limited general partnership. The state writes all the laws, rules, and regulations concerning the partnership. The boy and the girl don't write any of the rules. They're just bound by all of the terms and conditions that go with it. And they give you such things as free public education, the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. Of course, you've got to be taxed in order to come up with the $6,000 a year plus to educate this child in the free public education system. I know it's an oxymoron, but that's what people have bought into. And after all, if that's what they want, I don't want to get in the way of their happiness and success. Number two, a common law marriage is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl. There may be a written instrument, but a written instrument is not necessary. The marriage is done by agreement and penetration, and that's what marriage is, agreement and penetration. Many states recognize common law marriage. Most do not. Property and children by the birth certificate of the parties. And it is a little different from the civil law marriage as it's used today in the United States. Third is called a patriarchal marriage. Patriarchal marriage comes from the scripture. It's a contract between the boy and the girl's father. The father gives the girl to the boy in a public ceremony and transfers his liability to the boy. In Hebrew law, a female must be taken care of from the cradle to the grave. The contract terminates upon consummation. So what we're dealing with here is a contract between the boy and the girl's father. Well, you can have a contract between the boy and the state, which is, in fact, the girl's father, a surrogate father, because her real biological father gave her to the state by passing his seed through the fire to Moloch by getting a birth certificate when the child was born. So the boy goes to the state to get a marriage license, to get permission from the parent, the father, the state, to marry the female. So what's changed? Well, your property and your property rights have changed. By contrast, under a patriarchal marriage, you go to the girl's father and you contract with him and you pay what's known as the bride price. Bride price. That's the amount of money that you pay to the father for the transfer. You see, if you're going to buy something, you have to have consideration. And the bride price is the consideration for the purchase of the goods. It's a property right. Under a civil law marriage, there are no property rights. From each according to his ability and to each according to his need. And of course, that fits right in with the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property in land. We'll stand by, we'll take a break here, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, the endorsements or recommendations that we give does not necessarily mean that the authors or publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or sectarian. They're racial or ethnic partisans who do not necessarily endorse the opinions or beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. All right, a couple of items that we need to talk about are the contract for marriage, which is a prenuptial agreement. A prenuptial agreement is simply a contract that spells out the property rights of the contracting parties. Now, another factor that you should consider when you're marrying are the qualifications for the wife, or if you're a female, the qualifications for a husband. What are you looking for in a husband? Some guy that's groovy or slick talker or a good looker, or he has a car that you like or something on that order? Is this guy somebody that can support you, or are you going to support him? My grandmother used to say, she married well. Sometimes she'd reverse that out and say, well, she married poor white trash. Now, the qualifications for a wife in our family look something like this. A female that we're looking to marry should be fair complexioned, tall, Israelite or German, from 10-plus generations of good breeding, that is, no mixed blood, politically conservative, non-denominational Christian, trained in or willing to be trained in the law of Moses, a practitioner of the law of God, be versed in the duties of a woman pursuant to Proverbs 31, trained in cooking, cleaning, gardening, medicine, preserving, planning, and child-rearing, or be willing to be taught, intellectually oriented, has a head for business, athletic or active, intelligent, articulate, literate and well-read, should be well-traveled, have a good sense of humor, 25 to 35 years old, can be divorced with children, no mixed blood children, and in good health. The female should be strong, not frail, but not built like a lady weightlifter, without any operations for removal of vital organs such as gallbladder, tonsils, adenoids, female organs, or appendix. Free from TB, VD, cancer, diabetes, AIDS, or other degenerative diseases, physical deformities, or obesity. Free from mental defects, has no family history of genetic diseases. Has a dowry of $25,000 to $50,000 in cash or property. Has productive work habits, prepared to leave parents, free from Social Security, free from the birth certificate, free from state contracts, free from 14th Amendment citizenship, and free from all guardian ward relationships, and must be competent to enter into a marriage contract. Now, we spend more time in this country breeding dogs and cats, and we're a whole lot more concerned about breeding animals than we are breeding humans. And look at the offspring that comes from it. Just thought I'd throw that one in there. As a cattle breeder, let me tell you that we're very concerned about the kind of cows and bulls that we breed together. Human beings ought to be no less concerned. All right, now one more item over here that you should be concerned about is the common law marriage. This comes from Common Law Marriage, cited from Words and Phrases, a couple of three definitions. Let's see, where's page one here? To constitute a common law marriage, there must be an agreement between the parties. It's a present consent to take each other as husband and wife, to enter into a relationship which has or was to continue until death with the resulting obligations of husband and wife. And while the consent is of itself sufficient, there is no substitute to or equivalent such as sexual relations living together or using the same name. And an arrangement between a man and a woman cohabiting together for 27 years and adopting a child on application stating that they were husband and wife constituted a common law marriage. And a common law marriage, to be valid, is something more than a mere contract, and the contract must be acted upon by the parties, resulting in a marriage status between the man and the woman so contracting. So, marriage is a business. Marriage is a contract. Marriage is a deal that you're about to make. And as a result of that, since it is a business arrangement or a business deal, it ought to be treated like a business deal. All right, the last item that we'll take up here on marriage is the doctrine of parens patriae. Remember, I mentioned to you a little earlier that under the doctrine of parens patriae, you give your child to the state. Now, we entered into this geopolitical circumstance in about 1000 to 1100 BC. It's recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 8. It's where our ancient forefathers went to Samuel, the last judge in Israel, and said, "We want a king like all the nations around us." And God warned us at that time. He said, "You know, this king that you want to set over you is going to tax you to death, and he's going to take your property from you. This is not a good idea." And we said, "Nevertheless, we will have a king." Well, now here's the history of the doctrine. The origin of the doctrine of parens patriae, that's spelled P-A-R-E-N-S, P-A-T-R-I-A-E, parens patriae, in the law can be traced to medieval and late medieval English chancery courts, where parens patriae played an important role in maintaining the structure of feudal society. Chancery, as an agent of the monarchy, had a duty to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another, and to ensure that there would be someone available to perform these duties. And the concept of parens patriae was usually invoked in connection with problems of property or guardianship. That's what we're practicing today. The doctrine of parens patriae. It's the duty of the state to make sure that there's a workforce trained to take over the next generation's duties. So the process of the deliberate dumbing down of America is to deprive Americans of the ability to think for themselves. And Americans go to public school and they don't come out with an ability to think. They come out indoctrinated. They come out with trained rote. And they're especially noticeable in the military or in civil service jobs where they're unable to think outside the book. I've got to call my supervisor. I've got to go by the book. Not the best circumstance for business. Now, in some of the colonial statutes, we can see the beginnings of the idea that children are to be protected not only from poverty, but also from parents who are undeserving. Lord Redesdale maintained that parents have rights to their children only as a privilege granted by the state, and that the state delegates control over children to their parents as a trust. And that it does so because parents usually discharge this trust faithfully on behalf of their children. It's a guardian-ward relationship. The state owns the children and you're a babysitter. The right of a parent and parental control is a natural but not an unalienable one. And in the trust referred to by Lord Redesdale, the settlor or creator of the trust is the state. The trustee is presumably the child's natural parents, and the beneficiary of the trust It's called a sesdecuy trust, is the minor child. So when you get a birth certificate, when you participate in civil law marriage with a marriage license and you get a birth certificate and you participate in Social Security and what President Bush calls the safety net. Safety net. When you participate in that, you create a sesdecuy trust. You have a sesdecuy trust for you, one for your wife, and one for each of your children. And the state directs it. So when people complain that the state is eroding or encroaching upon their freedoms, hey, listen, you're the proximate cause of your own injury. You went out and did these things, or your parents did it for you because they were members of a feudal society. The fiduciary relationship does not rule out the satisfaction of interests that parents have as individuals. Now, they may not criticize these standards on the grounds that the parents are a specific child's parents, that they know what is best for their own child, and that they believe some other goals are more appropriate in their child's particular case. Since the theory of parents patriae regards parental authority over children as derived from the state, parents have no right, simply as parents, to define their own standards of child rearing and to demand that the state confine its requirements to minimal standards of care and education. The state might adopt minimal standards or maximal standards, but parental rights are merely creatures of the state. And individual parents have no independent source of authority on the basis of which to challenge the judgment of the state as regards the proper direction for parenting. This is why the Department of Family Services comes in and takes your children away from you and gives them to somebody else. In other words, the state is changing babysitters. That's what it boils down to. And that's because those are not your children. Now, if you want children and you want to own them and you want to practice the Mosaic law and you want to have property and property rights, then you have to practice what you preach. Now, the churches of America are in league with the political establishment of America. They work hand in glove. And they work hand in glove in opposition to the Bible, in opposition to the Scripture, in opposition to the law of God, in opposition to the law of Moses. Now tuck that one away in your heart. The belief that children themselves have no rights under the trusteeship model perhaps stems from the assumption that trusts are a type of contract. It is, however, a well-established principle in the law that trusts may be enforced by a beneficiary who is not a party to it, while only the actual parties to a contract can normally sue upon it. And this is why you have children who go to their teachers or they go to the authorities and complain about their parents. All right, we're about out of time. We'll have to cut it off right there. I think that just about takes care of the subject matter of marriage, at least. I hope that we've answered the question here for you, Mark, and we'll see you tomorrow night, same time, same station. You've been listening here to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, there's my signal. Says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.